Now, the Sermon on the Mount is filled with numerous parable-like allusions. It talks about salt and light, a city set on a hill, a lamp, a bushel, a lampstand, a judge, an officer, a footstool, a door, a moth, rust, thieves, talks about the eye, it talks about darkness, birds, lilies, an oven, a moat, a beam, dogs, pearls, fish, a serpent, a gate, a way, sheep, wolves, fruits, fires, rocks, floods, wind, and sand, and there are others. The Sermon on the Mount is a stepping stone to Jesus' many parables which he told throughout the course of his 3+ years walking upon this earth and ministering among people. So we will, in time, the Lord willing, turn our attention to these parables, but right now we're studying the Sermon on the Mount. It's not my intention to go through everything verse by verse, but I do want you to see the intent and overall picture of the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount is odd for us to study because of its structure. That's one thing about it. Because he does things backwards from the way we study and think things. We will have a premise. That is, we will have a basic argument or a basic idea, a basic truth or a basic doctrine, a basic historical event, and then from there we will talk about what comes out of that premise. But what he does is he gives an argument, a presentation, and then afterward he states the premise. So if you don't see that, then it's easy to miss what Jesus is talking about. So let me show you a little bit about this argument and premise idea. So the Sermon on the Mount begins with a series of arguments. His arguments, his presentation, begins in verse 3, and it goes all the way through verse 16. And his argument has to do with the way those are who are blessed. They're poor in spirit, they mourn, they're meek, they hunger after thirst and righteousness, and so forth. They're salt and they're light, and they don't cover themselves up. In verse 21 through verse 47 of this same chapter, he also is giving an argument. But he gives his premise in verse 17 and 18 and 20. Here is the premise. Verse 17, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And then he goes on and he speaks down through verse 20. Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. From verse 17 through verse 20, that's the first statement of the premise. That's what he's arguing right there, is that your righteousness is a righteousness that he came to fulfill, and the righteousness that you must have must exceed that of the very best of men, the scribes and the Pharisees. That's the premise. The argument has gone before, and now he begins to give the argument afterwards, and that argument is a part of what we're talking about today, going from 21 all the way through verse 47. So turn over to verse 47. You see the end of the argument, and in verse 48, you have a restatement of his premise. Here's the premise in verse 48. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. So everything that he's been talking about in between has to do with how it is that a man must be perfect. So that's, again, a restatement of the premise. Now, when you come to chapter 6, in chapter 6, his argument goes all the way from verse number 1 to the very last verse, the very end of this in verse 32, goes all the way through. That's his argument. His premise is in verse 33 and 34, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for tomorrow, for the thought of itself enough frustration for these things, sufficient unto day is the evil thereof. That is a statement of his premise. Well, that may not quite make sense to you what I'm trying to say, but that's one of the reasons that this passage, this sermon, seems backwards to us. It's because he gives his argument and then his premise, Whereas we would always give our premise, and then we would give our arguments. For example, the last hour, I told you that I was going to talk about those things of being broken and that he was going to be blessed. Those words that I gave you. Well, here, I gave you my premise and then I gave the arguments. Here, he does it the very opposite. But that is also there also is something else that we must see. And that is that there is a theme that is here, and that theme has to do with righteousness. But number one, if you don't know what righteousness is, or if righteousness is not important in the scheme of your thought and theology, then righteousness in the Sermon on the Mount is not going to be important to you. But let me show you how important it is to our Lord. In this particular passage, go back with me again in chapter 5 and in verse number 6. He said, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness." So there's the first use of this word. In verse 10, it appears again, "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake." And then in verse 17, verse 18 rather, "Verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass," verse 17, we'll read it together, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled." And then verse 20, "That except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no wise enter." And then in chapter 6, in verse 33 again, you have this righteousness again. "Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness." So this righteousness that he's talking about is a very important righteousness all the way through here. And all the way through this is what he's talking about. Now, speaking directly to the disciples in verses 3 through 12, he tells them what are the characteristics of those who are part of the kingdom. And then he calls them salt and he calls them light. Salt cannot kill bacteria, but salt can preserve against bacteria and against decay. Light itself cannot enlighten, but it can enshine upon those things which have to do with enlightenment. What are the good works that he's talking about in verse 16? But he's talking about the preservation of the gospel to our generation by shining upon this righteousness worked out by the work of Christ, his glorious person, and his justifying work at the cross. Well, with that little bit said, probably more than what I should try to talk about, he turned his attention in verse 21 to talk about the fifth commandment. And that fifth commandment has to do with anger. But I want you to go back with me, actually about killing. But I want you to go back with me in verse 19. And this is what he's talking about throughout the rest of this whole sermon. "Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these commandments." Now, when he talks about commandments, you remember that I talked about that last week? That Greek word is entele, and is a word that means requirements or laws. And what he's demonstrating is that the scribes and the Pharisees are guilty before God's law. So the first one that he's going to mention is the commandment have to do with killing in verse 21. Then he's going to talk about the commandment having to do with adultery beginning in verse 27. So you see he's giving a little discussion on killing or anger. Then he's going to talk about adultery, two very important matters. So the question is, how well do we have to keep these commandments? Well, if you look at the end of verse 26, you have to pay the very last or uttermost farthing. It's an allusion to keeping all and every bit of the law. How good do you have to be? Look over in verse 48. "Be ye therefore perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." How good do you have to be in order to be saved by your own righteousness? Well, there it is. So Paul put it this way in Galatians 3, Cursed is everyone that continues not in all things which are written in the books of the law to do them. Peter put it this way, where God said, he quoted God saying, "Be ye holy, for I am holy." James put it this way, "Whosoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point shall be guilty of all." So you have people who try to keep the Sabbath day. You have people who try to keep dietary laws. You have people who try to keep up with pleasing God by reading their Bible. People who try to keep their right relationship with God by praying. How good do you have to pray? How well do you have to read the Bible? How well do you have to keep all of these laws? If you offend in one point, you are guilty of all. So when Jesus lays down this statement, "Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these requirements and teaches others to do so, he is guilty of all." That's what Jesus is saying. So now he's going to begin to illustrate that. And so that's what he begins with, talking about the fifth commandment in verse 21, the commandment having to do with killing. So in verse 21, he says, "Thou shalt not kill." Now, if a man killed another in that day, he would have to be brought before the land's civil courts, or ultimately have to go to their supreme court, which was the Sanhedrin court. So they would have to go before those courts. And these Pharisees were a very litigious bunch. So if a man just did anything that they thought was against the law, because the forefathers before them had come up with a list of nearly 500 laws explaining the law. So laws on top of laws, so a man could always be found guilty of something. Not doing enough or doing too much. They're very litigious, and they could bring them before the courts at just the drop of a hat. So they used the law to control people. And this they did with Jesus, if you will think about it. That's exactly the way they ended up trapping him, was by using the law. So Jesus states the law, "Thou shalt not kill." And then he says, "But this is what I say to you. It's not only if you kill someone, but whosoever is angry with his brother." Angry with his brother, he says to him and calls him a name, Raca, down here. Or if he calls him a fool on down here. These are all a part of the same thing. Jesus stated Moses isn't setting up a cause to be taken to the courts. Jesus is showing the law truly has to do with the hearts. Now, what does he mean? There are two questions I think that we have when we look at this verse. First of all, what does he mean without a cause? Well, I don't know that I can totally answer that. But what he's talking about is unjustifiable anger. The problem is, as Solomon said, that the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes. So when you get angry, you always think you're justified. Or as he put it in another place, every way of man is right in his own eyes. So when you're angry, you always think you're justified to be angry. But these two verses that I just read conclude like this. The ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirits. Every man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord ponders the heart. So these Pharisees, these scribes, had made the law a matter of outward. It was external. So if you killed, then yes, you would go before the courts. But the law really tells us that it's God who weighs the heart, and that's exactly what Jesus is saying. The anger that was driven the person to bitterness is displayed in that he has gone to name-calling. That's what he means when he says, "Raca, and thou fool." Raca was a Hebrew name that means to say to someone, it's an ugly name, to say that he is a vain person. He's empty, he's shallow, he's empty-headed. That's what he means to say that. But when he says, "Thou art a fool," he is saying to him that you don't believe in God. You are not a God-fearing person. So it has driven him to this name calling. Now, there is a justified anger that you can find in the Bible. For example, it says of Moses in Exodus 32 and verse 19, as he had been up on the mount and received the law, as soon as he came down to the camp, he saw the calf. You remember that Aaron had led them into having a golden calf, and they were dancing and singing and having a wonderful time. And then it says, and Moses' anger waxed hot, and he cast the tables out of his hands and broke them beneath the mount. Now, in his anger, he didn't do what was right, but he was justified with being angry at them for what they did. But it is assumed that him becoming angry in that fashion is one of the reasons that he was not permitted to enter into the promised land. But there's another one, Jonathan, who was the son of Saul. In 1 Samuel 20 and verse 34 it says, so Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger, for he was grieved for David because of what his father had done to him. So he was angry at his own father for what he had done to David. But it also is said of Jesus in Mark 3 and 5, and when he looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, Jesus was angry with them. The book of Romans is all about the wrath of God. Well, that word wrath is the word thumos, and it's a word for anger, and it tells of God's anger against sin. With Jesus was angry. Was he angry when he overthrew the money changer's table? I think he was. Was Paul angry when he was in his back mistreated and not honored by John Mark and sent him home? I think he probably was. Was he angry when he withstood Peter for his hypocrisy? I think that he possibly was. Yet Paul wasn't angry for being personally affronted, and Jesus wasn't angry at his captors, because it says in 1 Peter, who when he was reviled, he reviled not again, and when he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Anger is an inward sin, but it cannot be dealt with by civil courts. Civil courts only deal with actions. That would be true in our land. It would be true in the Sanhedrin court of the Jews. But anger is dealt with in God's court. And that's exactly what Jesus is saying. So when he comes down here and he says, shall be in danger of hell fire, he is saying that a man who is angry in an unjustifiable way, and the Lord looks at the heart, remember this is a heart matter, he is in danger of hell fire. So let me talk for a few moments about a few thoughts about anger. What are the causes of anger? Well, jealousy is a cause of anger, because you remember that Cain was very wroth or angry, and his countenance fell when his offering was not received. And he was jealous because Abel's was received. And jealousy is that green-eyed monster that drives a lot of anger. And jealousy is something that you can't live with in your heart. It'll eat you up. You have to let it go. You can't live with it. It'll destroy a marriage. It'll destroy a business. It'll destroy a church. Jealousy is a terrible thing. Another thing is pride. Jonah was a man who was so prideful as a Jew that he didn't want the gospel sent to the Gentiles. And so he tried to get away from God. God prepared a fish. That fish swallowed him up. And he was so convinced of what God had done that he said, salvation is of the Lord. But that still wasn't enough. He went over and he got underneath a little bit of shade. And he saw that God had blessed the Gentiles. And it says that he was displeased exceedingly and he was very angry. Why? Because of pride. He did not want the Gentiles to be brought to faith. So pride of faith. Pride of your face, pride of your race, pride of grace itself. Pride has all kinds of forms. Pride has all kinds of forms. We need to think not of those who have more than us and be envious of them, but we need to think of others, be glad for what everybody has, and help others succeed in life and do better. And then there's also another cause of jealousy, the cause of truth. Jeremiah says, "Wherefore the princes were wroth with Jeremiah." Why was it? Because he preached the truth, and smote him and put him in prison. And that's in Jeremiah 37 and verse 15. So I'll just mention three things. Jealousy, pride, and even truth can cause people to be angry with other people. What are the results of anger? Well, strife, because in Proverbs 29 and 22 it says, "An angry man stirs up strife, and a furious man abounds in transgression. Another result is just what we might call sin. James said, "For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." And then bitterness. Hebrews 12 and 15 says, "Lest any root of bitterness spring up and trouble you, and thereby many be defiled." You might be bitter about your childhood. Maybe you don't think your mom or your dad treated you right. You might be bitter toward a brother or a sister. You might be bitter toward some person, some man or woman that you worked with. But that root of bitterness springs up and it troubles you just at any little turn. It'll spring up and it will trouble you. You need to let all of that bitterness, let that bitterness go. We talked today about people who are passive-aggressive. People who appear passive outwardly, but underneath, they are aggressive. Well, that passive aggressiveness has to do with this bitterness, this anger that resides inside. So this is a person who is controlled by this root of bitterness. So I say to all of us, we cannot live with jealousy inside of us. We cannot live with bitterness inside of us. Let me talk a minute about overcoming anger. What does the Bible say about overcoming anger? Well, first of all, it says be slow to anger. The book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7 and verse 9, "Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry." Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry. Be slow. If you're going to be angry about something, be sure that it is something justifiable to be angry about. Second of all, be quick to depart from anger. Romans 12:19, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord.'" And then a third thing that I give to you, a fourth thing, and that is renounce anger. Be slow to anger, be quick to depart it, seek not revenge, and the fourth thing is renounce anger. Let no bitterness, all bitterness, and all wrath, and all anger, and clamor, and evil speaking, be put away from you with all malice. Renounce it. So when you find anger inside of you, renounce it. Put it away. You may say it's easier said than done. Well, I know it's easier said than done. If it weren't an issue, Jesus wouldn't be talking about it. Of course it's a hard thing. I know it's a difficult thing. But there is an antidote to anger. An antidote to anger. Do you know what it is? It's love. John said this, If a man say, "I love God," and hates his brother, he's a liar. He's not a liar about hating his brother. He's a liar about loving God. You can't love God and live in hate. For he that loves not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? That's in 1 John 4 and 20. What is the antidote to anger? It is love. Here's what Jesus is proving. Jesus is proving that you have broken this first commandment that I speak to you of, this commandment of anger. You're angry toward others. And He knew their hearts. I'm not there to be able to look into their hearts. But I know that the requirement of the law is so stringent that the very last farthing of the law has to be paid in order for it to be said that it is complete. So I say to you, let us not live with anger. Put this anger aside. We are believers. We're lovers of God. We're followers of Christ. We're His disciples. We're learners of His. May God give us love toward Him, love toward His gospel, toward His church, and toward this vexing world. This vexing world. Sure, it's a vexing world. But still, may we have love toward this vexing world that is around us.